Welcome back, everybody. It's the Damage Report. I'm John Arola. Big show coming up in just a little bit. We're going to be joined by progressive activist Jordan Yule to break down some of the big news of the day, including Donald Trump's voter fraud conspiracy theory that he's been pushing as of late. We've got a rally activist going to be joining us to break down a rally going on in Dayton very soon, as well as candidate Kara Eastman coming back in for a second round. Came very close last time around to winning a congressional seat, and this time she seems well positioned to win that seat. So we're going to be talking to her about her candidacy and a little bit of updated news on mass shootings that have been stopped. So actual good news, but there is a common thread in many of the recent attacks that have been stopped, which we're going to break down, as well as how worried are people about white nationalist terrorism? Turns out it differs greatly between groups, and we're going to be describing that to you. But before all of that, we've got a big topic to handle, and that is the lies of Ben Shapiro. So we're going to be starting off with that. Yesterday on his program, Ben Shapiro said just about the most dishonest thing I've literally ever heard in politics. It was an insult to literally everyone who was watching his program, and it had to do with the approach of the Republican Party to Barack Obama back during his presidency. Take a look.
Republicans impeached Bill Clinton in the 1990s. They never made a move to impeach Barack Obama, despite the myriad scandals that cropped up during his administration. I'm not aware of a single major Republican figure who said that Barack Obama was not the legitimate president of the United States, despite the fact that Democrats have claimed that George W. Bush was illegitimate. They've claimed that Donald Trump is illegitimate. So this is just not true. And doubts about Barack Obama's belief system came from Barack Obama being an extraordinarily radical figure. Barack Obama said he wanted to fundamentally transform the nature of the country. That's a pretty radical statement.
Okay, that was a pretty radical statement. He did say at one point, and this is just not true, I hope he was referring to what he was literally saying at that moment, because nothing he said there is true, or even I don't know how you could say something as stupid as that and get paid to talk about politics. I mean, I actually do. He gets paid by billionaires to advance their economic interests. That's literally the only reason he exists as a human being, or let alone a media figure. But the idea that nobody questioned the legitimacy of Barack Obama, that was literally the only thing 40% of the country did for an 8-year span, including, by the way, Ben Shapiro, which we're going to return to. Now, did any prominent Republicans question the legitimacy of Barack Obama's presidency? Let's start with one that you might have heard of, Donald Trump, a guy whose political career literally is only about birtherism. That is how he got to be a big name in Republican circles leading up to his run for the presidency, was pushing year after year after year the racist birther conspiracy theory that asserted that because Barack Obama wasn't born in the US, he literally cannot be president. That's what they said year after year, and he spent every minute he could going on every show that would accept him to do that. Now, that was such an obvious counter to Ben Shapiro's willful lies during that segment that he, of course, had to shift the goalposts. And he did that very quickly, tweeting, "Trump was a fringe character for nearly the entirety of the Obama presidency. He wasn't a Republican figure until he ran. You can't name a single major elected Republican official during Obama's presidency who challenged the legitimacy of his presidency." So all that is shifting the goalposts. Now, it's ridiculous to say that he wasn't prominent at that time. And we're going to return at the very end. How prominent was he? Not in general, but specifically to Ben Shapiro. That's going to be a fun little end cap on this story. But that's simply moving the goalposts. He is the president now. That's how he got conservatives to support him, including Ben Shapiro, by the way. So the idea that he was just a fringe character is literally insane. And the issue is that the context he's trying to put on this is the exact opposite one. The issue isn't just that prominent elected Republicans did question legitimacy, and we're going to list any number of them in just a minute. It's that literally every aspect of the Republican Party of conservative thought during the Barack Obama presidency was founded in birtherism. It infested their elected officials, their candidates, their media, and their voters, and we're going to be going through all of them in this segment. So, okay, if Donald Trump doesn't count, then let's move on to a few prominent Republicans, including Sarah Palin, who said in response to a question by radio hosts on whether she would make Obama's birth certificate a campaign issue in 2012, she said, "I think the public rightfully is still making an issue. I don't have a problem with that. I don't know if I would have to bother to make it an issue because I think that members of the electorate still want answers." So she had just got done being their vice presidential candidate a month and a half earlier. I would say fairly prominent. Now, she didn't get elected, thank God, but she was pretty prominent at the time. Okay, maybe she doesn't count though because she wasn't elected. What about the Speaker of the House, one of the most powerful Republicans over the past couple of decades, Newt Gingrich, who said, I know that there is a desperate need to attach racism to everything, but in fact, I think that Donald Trump said what he said because it's the right thing for him to say, talking about Donald Trump's birther comments. So Newt Gingrich, who's supposed to be like the wonk, the serious, the intellectual Republican, he was their strong leader in the 90s. He was apologizing for Donald Trump's birtherism back in 2012, back in May then. Pretty prominent Republican, I would say. But okay, he wasn't elected at that particular moment. Let's turn now to some elected Republicans, including Senator David Vitter, who responded to a question about Barack Obama's birth certificate saying, quote, I personally don't have standing to bring litigation in court, but I support conservative legal organizations and others who would bring that to court. I think that is the valid and most possibly effective grounds to do it. So a sitting senator said that not only should we be questioning it in our rhetoric, but we should be bringing it to court. Pretty prominent, pretty important. Let's turn now to the House. We have Mark Meadows, who said 2012 is the time we are going to send Mr. Obama home to Kenya or wherever it is. That's an elected representative saying that Barack Obama should go back to where he comes from, years ahead of Donald Trump there, and it's Kenya or whatever. He doesn't even know what conspiracy theory he actually supports. He's not the only one in the House who said that. You remember Michelle Bachmann? She was not only a representative, she did fairly well as a Republican presidential candidate for quite some time. On Good Morning America, which invited her on, she said, well, it isn't for me to state about his origins, that's for the president to state. Because it's on him. She doesn't know. Who's to say whether he was born in America or in some other country? That's for him to deal with. So there's a representative and a candidate. You have another presidential candidate and a former governor for the Republican Party, Mike Huckabee. He was talking with Steve Malzberg on WOR in New York, and he said he would love to know more about the circumstances of Obama's birth, adding, quote, what I know is troubling enough. That was another presidential candidate. At one point, many people thought he could be the next nominee for the Republican Party, openly questioning it. And so you have tons of former candidates, vice presidential candidates, senators, representatives, but you also have it infesting right-wing media for almost a decade, including Sean Hannity, who said in 2011, if you ask the question, all right, well, why not just show us the certificate? Ah, you're a birther, that's what you are. It's not been my number one issue, but I've been following it and I've been saying, why are all these people that just asked to see it, why are they crucified and beaten up and smeared and besmirched the way they are? So Sean Hannity, I mean, it's not his number one issue. Don't get me wrong, if it turns out to be absolute BS, don't tar me with that. But I'm just asking questions. I just wanna know, why is it so bad to want the first black president to give his birth certificate? Don't we ask everybody to give a birth certificate? He literally said that later. Everybody, every candidate gives their birth certificate. It's not true. It's not remotely true. And so look, we had Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson has talked about it. Laura Ingraham, of course, pushed it for literally years. You had Eric Bolling who said, we haven't touched it, but there is a legitimate question as to whether or not the president of the United States is allowed to be president of the United States. So no big deal, but all of our candidates, people running for president and our media, we all think that either he definitely wasn't born here or it's a legitimate question to ask. Why are you getting so mad at us, huh? We're just saying maybe he's not actually eligible to be president. Maybe we're just questioning his presidency. And that effect from candidate down to media was so strong over such a long period of time that even years and years after this stopped being a topic of conversation, it was still the default position for Republican voters. In a Newsweek study, this is published in Newsweek, in December of 2017, we're talking just a couple of years ago, 57% of Republicans said it was definitely true or probably true that Barack Obama was born in Kenya. 57%, that's higher than the percentage who believe that climate change is happening. I mean, give any fact, they're more likely to believe that Barack Obama was born abroad than almost anything else. That's how strong it was. But nobody questioned his legitimacy, right? Why are they doing it to Donald Trump? Why are they being so mean? We were perfectly fine to Barack Obama. And that's where we return to Ben Shapiro, who not only is giving the middle finger to his audience with these blatant lies, forget all that stuff about him being an intellectual gladiator, the cool kids philosopher, he's just a pundit, a lying pundit who lies to his own audience. I mean, honestly, like the idea is that he's, I guess, disrespecting me or other libs, but we don't watch his show. The people who watch his show are hardcore right wingers and he's lying to them. Does anyone disrespect, does anyone hate their audience as much as someone who would lie this blatantly to them? And not just about these facts that we've showed you. It's not just that he either doesn't know or pretends he doesn't know that so many candidates and so many media figures said these sorts of things. It's that he knows what he said at the time. And that's the most insidious part of these lies. And so we turn to Ben Shapiro. Now, Ben Shapiro was savvy enough at the time to pretend that he wasn't really sure. He was savvy enough to never come right out and say that Barack Obama definitely wasn't born in the United States. But it turns out he was a little bit savvier than that, because he was savvy enough to know at that time that that's what the audience wanted to hear. And so he spent years playing both sides and trying to have his cake and eat it too, pretending, oh, it's not the big issue to me. And yet it did inform his politics in some interesting ways. And so let's turn to that. He said back in April 2011, the birther story has always been a non-issue to me, but I actually find Obama's untimely release more disquieting than the hubbub. So that's very similar to Tucker Carlson's position on this. It's the racist attacks against the first black president, that's not the problem. It's the way Barack Obama handled them, that's the problem. But the thing is, his interest in this and his writing about it goes much further. He said back in April of 2011 on Front Page Magazine, the media has shown its usual incredulity at the indisputable stupidity of the American people. How could so many people question President Obama's birthplace? How could they wonder about his origins? Are they all simply racist? The answer, of course, is that Americans are desperately seeking an answer to a simple question. Why does President Obama appear to be so un-American? So it's not his issue, but he certainly understands where they're coming from. And he says this, and look at the strain weaving throughout the paragraph I'm going to read you of wanting to have it both ways on this. Ironically enough, the biggest problem for America arises if President Obama was born here. Because if he was, the problem of un-Americanism is now internal rather than external. Perhaps that is why so many Americans wonder about the birth certificate. They hope against hope that President Obama is a symptom of a foreign ill rather than a domestic one. No matter whether Jerome Corsi comes up with evidence of Obama's foreign birth, however, it is clear that the problem of Obama-esque un-Americanism is now endemic to American culture herself. We have an ideological problem in our midst, and no amount of digging in Kenya and Indonesia is going to solve a problem that now starts right here. So there he's saying Jerome Corsi, who wrote a book about this, by the way, he might turn up something. Does that sound like a person who doesn't believe these conspiracy theories? He is absolutely desperate to have it both ways. The thing is, in the end, he had it both ways on the issue, but not on the political aspect of that issue. And that's where we turn back to Donald Trump. Because Ben Shapiro would love to have you believe that he's the reasonable Republican and he doesn't buy into all this conspiracy theorizing, which is odd. Because did you know that back during that period, he actually supported a candidate as the next potential nominee? Do you know who that was? It was Donald Trump. Back in April of 2011, he tweeted, "Why I back Donald Trump on the Ben Shapiro show at big810am.com. Now, I have not been able to actually find that show, but I did find his writing and it got into why he supported Donald Trump of all people. Back in 2011, he said this, "In reality, the birth certificate issue is specifically geared towards certain political ends for Trump. First, it is obviously calculated to attract the most anti-Obama segment of the conservative base. And remember, it just attracted him. Is Donald Trump the best Republican candidate for president out there? It would be tough to argue otherwise. He's got all the makings of a breakout star. He's got bravado and the cash to back it up. If he really runs, he won't have any trouble finding supporters. Looks like he already has one. And as he puts it, he is the Obama administration's worst nightmare. So far, who can argue with him?" So remember, he just got done yesterday saying, "We never questioned his legitimacy. We never attacked him the way that they're attacking Donald Trump." And there he is lauding Donald Trump specifically because he's the worst nightmare of the president. How much more disingenuous could you possibly get? But here's the thing that I want you to bear in mind. There he talks about his money, his bravado. But I want you to ask yourself, why did he support Donald Trump in April of 2011? Why then did he do a podcast about it? Why did he write an article about it? Do you know what Donald Trump was doing for the 3 weeks leading up to that post by Ben Shapiro? He had actually been on a bit of a media blitz. He was on The View, Fox News, Laura Ingraham's show, which wasn't on Fox News at that time, The Today Show and Morning Joe. And on all of those programs, the only message he spread was the birther conspiracy theory. He spent 3 weeks doing that. And then all of a sudden, Ben Shapiro's a big fan. All of a sudden, Ben Shapiro literally wants him to be the Republican nominee. Weird how that works out from a guy who doesn't take in for any of this conspiracy theory stuff. That's who Ben Shapiro is, okay? We gotta pierce the bubble. This guy hates his audience. He hates logic. He hates facts. His feelings might be hurt by that. I apologize. Guy hates being quoted, but that's who he is. That's all the evidence. I mean, there's way more candidates we could talk about, but I think that's enough to make the point. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back. Jordan Ewell's gonna be joining us to break down some of the news of the day after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
It's beginning to look more and more like Donald Trump's literal last words will be about his election victory. Dude cannot get enough of talking about it, and he's not constrained by the facts or any connection to reality when talking about it. Yesterday, he had a new theory driven by a right-wing conspiracy site. He tweeted, "Wow, report just out. Google manipulated from 2.6 million to 16 million votes for Hillary Clinton in 2016 election. This was put out by a Clinton supporter, not a Trump supporter. Google should be sued. My victory was even bigger than thought." And apparently, this tracked down, this report that was just out was a study from 2 years ago that involved apparently 95 people. This is a psychologist, Robert Epstein, who believes that Google search results manipulated votes. Now, Google itself has said that there's absolutely nothing to this. And they only surveyed 95 participants, but that was literally enough in 2019 for the president to launch a new conspiracy theory that literally millions of Americans will now accept as true. And joining us on the program now to break down this new theory, progressive activist Jordan Ewell, welcome back to the show.
John, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. Wish we could be talking about something more positive, but we're back on these theories. What do you think about it?
So, I mean, the fact that we're having this conversation just reflects like this nightmarish, like hell world that we're living in. So, like you said, this isn't a new study. It was something that Trump saw on Fox Business a few minutes before his tweet. Mm-hmm. Fox Business was talking about this and pushing this, again, this conspiracy that social media and Google is out to get Republicans and Trump. And they, again, falsely claimed that all these votes were manipulated. And when you boil down what this study was, like you said, it was 95 people, very, very small sample size. Methodology, as people and experts have looked at it, it looks like it's deeply flawed. The system was designed to make no difference between an investigative piece in the New York Times or a solid piece of journalism in a flagship newspaper. And they couldn't distinguish that between a pro-Trump puff piece in Breitbart. Mm-hmm. And the value systems were equally weighted, which led to this deeply flawed finding that these people were influenced, right, because of distorted search results. They then used that and applied it to a much wider audience, and that's an issue with external validity. You can't apply this tiny sample size to 2. Some million people and expect it to be sound. Where Trump got this 16 million number, like nobody knows. Even the person who authored the study has no idea where that came from. It is completely farcical. But again, as we've talked about on the show time and time again, this pipeline between fringe right-wing conspiracy theories making its way through different blogs and outlets onto Fox News, onto Fox Business, in front of Trump's eyes and onto his Twitter feed, and then millions more people now believe it.
It's great analysis there. I want to ask you a question, though, because you have to watch a lot of right-wing media. I don't watch much Fox. I certainly don't watch Fox News. I'm not a businessman myself. What is Fox Business? Because you said that this was being covered on there. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with business. I recently saw a supercut of attacks against the lack of spirituality in the Democratic Party on Fox Business. Is it a business network?
Sometimes. So Fox, in theory, it should be. If Fox Business is kind of like this corporate PR outlet, right? And then like the business arm of Fox Corporation and Fox News. But like you said, it delves into other political issues. It's just another apparatus for the right wing and corporate infrastructure to exert influence and power over the country.
Yeah, I honestly don't know what role it fills. It seems like very often that a lot of the hosts on Fox Business are looking to potentially get jobs on Fox News. I don't know, maybe I'm reading in too much there. But I do want to turn to another topic, one that you've been doing a lot of work on personally, and that involves Tucker Carlson, who's recently been on vacation, obviously. Tucker Carlson back now from vacation, but he's returning to apparently a lot less advertisers than he used to. Let's bring up this Media Matters figure showing the drop in advertisers over the past couple of weeks, and you see, wow, they 60% fewer ads per show than before last fall when the advertisers started fleeing. Now, you were, of course, involved not only in this sort of study, but getting those advertisers to flee. So catch us up to date. How bad is it looking for Tucker Carlson?
Tucker Carlson's ad breaks are absolutely decimated. He's at one of his lowest points in his tenure as host of the show since the show debuted. He is extremely weak. No blue chip sponsor wants to associate with him. And this is because of his comments. And this isn't just a one or two time thing. This isn't a gaffe. This is a well-documented, repeated history of saying incendiary, racist, white nationalist things, pushing white nationalist and white supremacist conspiracy theories, saying misogynistic things, saying that women and high-earning women leads to the decline of men, saying immigrants make America dirtier and poorer and more divided, and most recently saying that white supremacy as an issue is a hoax. This is purely on him. Brands want nothing to do with him. By simply asking if companies intentionally advertise on his show, most don't even realize it because a lot of ad purchases are automated. So it's really not anything I'm doing or Media Matters is doing specifically. It's just taking these comments to these companies. There's a ton of support on this issue. Grassroots, like top down, everyone is involved on this and nobody wants to be associated with him because of his own rhetoric.
Yeah, as you pointed out, there's a lot of comments that have been going back a long time and up until even recently, right before his obviously previously scheduled vacation. The idea that just days after a white nationalist terror attack, he would turn his show into public relations for white nationalism is just abhorrent. And so what I'm wondering at this point is, considering how many horrible things he's said, and he's lost some sponsors before, do you have a fear that if time goes by, that they might start to trickle back? Or does this seem different than past instances of him having issues with advertisers?
So the past few months, advertisers have not been coming back for the most part. You'll see a couple here and there, they'll accidentally have an ad run. But largely, people are done for good. Some people are just dropping Fox News entirely because the rhetoric across the board is so inflammatory. What people need to understand now is that because of this gap filled on Tucker, everyone is running their ads elsewhere on the network. So if you're a sponsor, if you're advertising on Fox News in general, you are subsidizing Tucker Carlson's rhetoric. Yeah. And same thing for Laura Ingraham, same thing for Jeanine Pirro. If you are advertising on Fox, you are sponsoring white nationalism. You are sponsoring misogyny. You are sponsoring racism. There's no way around it. Like, you are subsidizing it because they won't just do anything about the rhetoric. They're just moving ads elsewhere.
So what about doing something about Tucker Carlson? Like, from your point of view, do we have any reason to believe that this might be bad for Tucker Carlson inside of Fox News? How much does Fox News care about the ad load of their hosts?
So I think there's a couple things here. I don't think that Fox Corporation cares. If you look at the Murdochs and how they've influenced media, how they've influenced politics around the world, white supremacy and white nationalism and people living in fear of these things does not affect them. If they can use this to make money, they will. They don't care. If it eventually hurts their bottom line, they might make a business decision. But a moral standpoint, absolutely not. I don't think that as a corporation, Fox doesn't care. So you then look at how they make their money. So ads is a small percentage of how they make their money. Carrier fees, the fees that you pay as a subscriber to a cable company, it then gets divvied up among cable channels. Fox demands like 2 to 3 times more than any other channel. So if people were to start taking action and saying like, hey, I don't want to pay for this, I'm not watching it, I don't want them in my standard package, I don't want my money going to Fox, you could then start to see maybe some needle moving on this issue because of the rhetoric. And it's nothing to do with them as an outlet, right? So if they were just a standard, you know, moderate outlet like CNN, no one would care. It's because of this rhetoric. So if consumers started to organize and take action on this cord cutting measure, you could see some change.
Well, that's interesting. Perhaps a next phase to dealing with the advertisers of Fox News or dealing with their financial Maybe. Underpinnings. Jordan Yule, as always, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, protests, candidates, and more after this. Dayton, Ohio is still very much in the immediate aftermath of the horrific attack of just a couple of weekends ago. People putting together their lives again. And now there is a rally to bring them together. It is the Enough is Enough Dayton Strong Rally. And joining us to talk about it is rally organizer Sammy Caruso. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. So I'd love to know more about this rally. When is it happening? Where is it happening? And what's the idea behind it?
So the rally's happening tomorrow at 4 o'clock downtown Dayton, and we're encouraging students. I'm a senior in high school myself, and we're encouraging students from around the Dayton area to join us in our rally. And more than just students, we're encouraging all citizens to come together and demand sensible gun laws. And so we're expecting around 2,000 to 3,000 people, and we're going to be, like I said, downtown and protesting.
So as you pointed out, you're a student yourself. This is a big thing to put together a rally like this. Do you have previous experience in organizing in this sort of way?
Yeah, so 2 years ago after the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas, myself along with some other students also organized a walkout at my school, and then we organized another one citywide. So we're trying to really make this one more about everyone instead of just the students, since this gun problem has become such a epidemic everywhere. Since the shooting itself was only 2 miles away from here, it was wow. affecting every single community. So,
yeah, and you know, obviously, my heart goes out to you and everyone else having to deal with that, as so many communities have had to recently. So you said you're bringing together everyone, you're pushing for sensible gun control. What are some of the ideas that you or the people you've been organizing with would classify under that category?
So we're classifying that as, first of all, a ban on assault weapons. We want manufacturer liability, extended background checks on a national level, a ban on high-capacity magazines, and ending the gun show loophole. And so we, our current lawmaker, Representative Mike Turner, takes $25,000 from the NRA, and he has supported this military-style ban. But he will still takes money from the NRA. So we're also encouraging our lawmaker to donate that money and give it to the Dayton Foundation for victim relief.
I think that would be a great move. It would probably buy him some goodwill, although not from the NRA, obviously. And so, look, I don't know your particular political background, although with the Bernie sign, I could probably guess, assuming that's yours. That's a little bit of evidence. In the immediate aftermath of both the Dayton attack and El Paso, Donald Trump had said, hey, maybe we do something about background checks, which is, you know, for a lot of elected Republicans, they're not even willing to talk about that, no matter how popular they are. In the last couple of days, he has fled from that position after talking with the NRA. Were you disheartened to see the lack of progress at the federal level?
It wasn't too surprising. I mean, Donald Trump used our city for a photo op. He called our city Toledo instead of Dayton. It wasn't too surprising. We're going to need people to get a backbone and cut. Well, not just in the House has pushed for stuff. We need the Senate and we need Mitch McConnell to put this sensible legislation on the table to move forward. So it's beyond just the executive branch. We need our Congress to move forward. And in Ohio, we need our state house to move forward.
Exactly. And so, look, I hope that the rally is a huge success. I hope a lot of people show up and get involved around this issue. I personally have thought for a long time that one of the issues is that while the pro-gun rights people, it's like their core issue for many of them. For people who want common sense gun control, lots of them do, but they don't prioritize it quite so much. But So do you think that it might be time for people to start to move it up their rank of their ranking of priorities?
Definitely. And I think now too, everyone, and this is different than it was even last year, is acknowledging the whole mental illness thing. But if they can acknowledge that there are people that are mentally ill, but they can't acknowledge the fact that those mentally ill people can legally purchase a firearm, then I'm really optimistic that our generation is in people now are going to be making those changes for the future, and that they're going to be coming from a grassroots level. But until that happens, nothing's really going to change. Why will today be any different, or tomorrow be any different than today? So.
And thankfully, over the past couple of years, we've had a lot of activism around this issue, and especially coming from younger people, from students. You mentioned, you know, the Parkland students, and you yourself have been organizing. And so I know that this is about Dayton, it's not about you, but I do want to ask you, I know that you've previously done a TED Talk about student activism. So how did you get involved in this so young? What are some of the projects you've been involved in? And I ask you mainly because I know there's a lot of younger people watching who might themselves want to get involved in these sorts of efforts.
Yeah, definitely. So what really got me involved at first was actually Bernie's 2016 campaign. Back when I was in eighth grade, I was just super interested in what he had to say.
You've got a lot of life ahead of you. I'm very envious of you right now.
But that got me really interested. And I think especially for young people today, almost all of these issues are going to be affecting us specifically. I mean, if you look at climate change, the gun issue, the mental health issue, the college affordability issue. And so seeing these issues become so real and actually affect me when they're not affecting a lot of the people above me that are actually making the decisions, I think that's when it really clicked with me that I should be taking the initiative and making that change. And so that's what I'm trying to encourage other young people to do is they want to see a change. They got to put themselves forward and make that change happen because, frankly, everyone, our lawmakers have really failed us. So,
I couldn't agree more. And thank you for everything that you're doing. Just once again, if you could let people know where they can go for more information about tomorrow's rally.
So the rally is going to be in downtown Dayton tomorrow, August 21st at 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Courthouse Square. And if you want more information, it is bit.ly/DaytonStrong with caps. And that will have the time of the walkout and the location of the rally.
Awesome. Sammy Caruso, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, Canada will be joining us to break down a really exciting candidacy in this next cycle after this. Joining us now is the candidate for Nebraska's 2nd Congressional District, Kara Eastman. Welcome back to the Damage Report.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. Very excited for your candidacy. We're going to talk about, this is not your first time. You came extremely close in the last cycle, one of the closest races. And so we're going to talk about some differences between that race and this race. But before we get into that, I want to talk about some of your primary opponents, because it looks like at this point there are two, Ann Ashford and Morgan Freeman, not the actor. What do you know so far about these candidates and the apparent enthusiasm to try to take you on, even though you look like a very strong bet to win this thing in the general election?
Right, and actually there are other candidates as well. So what we did in the 2nd District of Nebraska was we made it cool to run for Congress finally. I do have a primary coming up. We're excited about the chance to put ideas out there, just like we're seeing on the presidential stage. But we're mostly excited because just the overwhelming amount of support that I've been getting on the ground, going out, talking to voters who are thrilled that I'm running again, who asked me to run again. And so we're just excited about the race and feel confident about our chances in this primary and just want to bring everybody along with us.
Well, see, and that's the thing, because you were so close, you still have this built-in base. You're the sort of candidate where the Democratic leadership should be jumping on it to back you and support you. So far, when you're talking about like the DCCC, the DNC, has there been any contact? Is it clear where they stand?
it's pretty clear where they stand. They're recruiting somebody else to run against me. And so no, we are not really talking to them. I mean, we're just going to talk to voters. And I think people are tired of the parties in general being so polarizing and having their pick of who they decide should win. We're going to let the voters in the second district of Nebraska decide.
Okay, so let's turn now to the issues. What do you see the candidacy in this primary especially? How are you going to differentiate yourself from what looks like at least two or more candidates? What are some of the issues you're going to be focusing on?
Well, the issues that we're focusing on are really the things that the voters are telling us that they're interested in. Healthcare still comes up, and it's the number one thing people talk about. And right now, people are afraid. They're afraid of losing their healthcare. They're afraid of losing their Social Security and their pensions. So we have to make sure that we're focusing on expanding access to healthcare, access to earned benefits, instead of taking them away. You know, the economy and jobs is something that we hear about a lot in the second district, where we have some people prospering, but most people are not. Most people are still having to work two or three jobs. Communities of color are struggling, and we need representatives who are going to stand up for them. That tax bill has hurt so many people in this district, and we've actually been putting out calls on social media for people to come to us and tell us what's happened to them. Most people are paying more in taxes, except for the wealthy people. And I have wealthy donors coming to me and saying, actually, we're paying less and we don't really need that handout. So those are the two things that we're going to be focused on in this election. And really, our stance is the same as it's always been. Let's go out, let's bring government back to the people, and let's put people above the wealthy and large corporations that have far too much influence today in American politics.
So one aspect of you're talking about access to healthcare, one aspect that's seemingly even more under assault this time around is reproductive rights, that area of healthcare that the Trump administration has been targeting hardcore in an extremely extremist way recently. What is your approach on that topic and communicating with your constituents about it?
So I have a good friend who's a doctor in the district who keeps saying how tired, her name's Maureen. She keeps telling me how tired she is of government intervening in her practice. She's a qualified doctor. She's the one who should be making the decisions with her patients about healthcare. And I'm tired of this assault on women's reproductive health rights. What this gag rule is going to do is basically prevent women from getting access to healthcare. And we're seeing this around the country, but in the Nebraska second, this impacts a lot of people here. My daughter has been working for a group called the Women's Fund on access to sexual health education, access to reproductive health. And to me, I'm just looking at my 18-year-old daughter who's doing the right thing, and watching her congressperson try to take away her rights is despicable.
So you, as we mentioned, you came so close that just a swing of a couple points the last time around would have you occupying a seat in the House right now. And so I'm curious, as you're out there campaigning, you're seeing what's going on in the country. If it had gone the other way, if today you were Congresswoman, what would you be doing? What would you be focusing on?
I'd be focusing, well, I mean, there's a lot to focus on right now. But first of all, I'm a little disappointed in the recess that our reps are taking right now when there's so much happening in our country. I would be focusing on the district and making sure that we're doing things that directly impact this district. We've got streets to repair. We've got housing that needs to be addressed. We still have too many potholes. And so we've got to have a representative that's actually going to defend and fight for the people here. Our current rep, the person that I lost to by a tiny margin, just held a town hall where he turned away over 200 people. And you know, is defending assault weapons, saying because a friend of his happens to have one. I mean, we need somebody who's actually going to represent us. This is ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good thing he doesn't have a friend who has a tank. We'd be in a very different position. What a ridiculous way to legislate. Anyway, you've also recently, you've spent some time visiting migrant detention centers. Can you tell us about that experience?
Yeah, so I went down to the border. My brother is an interpreter for the federal court system in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And I went down to the border, and we decided to go together to El Paso and to Juarez to see some of the shelters. We weren't actually able to go to a detainment center. We tried. But what we saw were so many people waiting for asylum, waiting for their immigration status to come through to be able to come to the United States legally. And then going to court with my brother and seeing this revolving door of deportations. It's heartbreaking. And right now, what we know is in El Paso, about 95% of the people who come in there are not going to get asylum. They're not going to get to stay in the United States. And these are people that are coming here because they want to visit their family or because they want to work. Our immigration system is so broken, and families obviously are being torn apart. I mean, they're literally being ripped apart by the Trump administration. But what I saw was so heartbreaking, and it just showed that there's a need for some very, very simple fixes to our system that aren't necessarily the sexiest things that people want to talk about. They're not what policymakers are excited about doing, but it's what we need people to do because our system is costing us way too much money, and it's completely broken.
Well, Kara, it's a very exciting candidacy. Hopefully, we can reconnect a little bit later on as the primary continues. And thank you again for joining us today on the show.
Thanks so much.
We're going to take one last break here. We come back, a few mass shootings that were stopped before they happened. We want to give credit where credit is due there, but also some disturbing findings from those investigations after this. It was just a couple of weeks ago that a white supremacist conducted a horrific terror attack in El Paso, but a lot can happen in 2 weeks, and a lot almost did. In the 2 weeks since that massacre, federal and local authorities have thwarted four additional threats they said could have resulted in mass attacks. All four of the alleged plotters, this is across Nevada, Connecticut, Florida, and Ohio, were heavily armed young white men. At least three of the four appear to have harbored hateful far-right views, especially towards Jewish, African-American, and LGBTQ people. And so if the pattern was not already easy enough to see, even in the attacks that didn't happen, thankfully, it is still very clear. And so let's talk briefly about what that means, what these actually look like, because a lot can seem glossed over in just a paragraph. But again, Nevada, Connecticut, Florida, Ohio. One of the four seems like a person who was suffering from massive depression, was suicidal, and wanted to break some sort of world record for an attack while they were killing themselves. So horrific in its own way, but with no clearly identifiable political connection to it. In the other three, though, the connection is very easy to identify. In Nevada, you had Connor Climo, who was stopped for allegedly planning to attack a local synagogue and a bar he believed to be popular with LGBTQ people. He admitted when he was questioned by the FBI that he belonged to a neo-Nazi group. Now, the FBI probably should have responded that, didn't you hear white nationalism is a hoax? That's what Tucker Carlson has been saying. He seemed to take the hoax very seriously though, and he wanted to kill people based on it. And again, threats to a bar popular with the LGBTQ community and a synagogue. The sort of threats that we should take seriously, but we're going to return at the end of this segment to how seriously we are taking it. Over in Connecticut, my home state, Brandon Wagshall posted that he embraced Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric, expressed hatred for minority groups, said, I quote, I support transgenders' rights to be some of the first in the gas chambers. And this is a person who was very clear in their social media activity what they thought about a variety of different groups that he had been taught to hate. In Ohio, you had James Reardon, who targeted a synagogue, or wanted to at the very least, and had a history of identifying as a white supremacist, including attending the infamous Unite the Right rally. Remember that rally that we were told we were making too big of a deal of just because they only killed one counter-protester there? God knows who else attended that is off somewhere across America and planning some sort of attack of their own. Thankfully, in the case of James Reardon, law enforcement was able to stop him. This is 2 weeks. 2 weeks, and in three different states, these same sort of people, they saw what happened in El Paso, and they didn't react with the horror that we did. They thought, you know what? How can I do my own? What spin can I put on this particular formula? And thankfully, there are people working to stop them. Now, when it comes to this threat, what do the American people actually think about it? Turns out it really depends on your group. So John Harwood tweeted out the results of an NBC Wall Street Journal post, a poll asking, are you worried the US will suffer another mass shooting by white nationalists? Now, if you look at Democrats, 82%, Hispanics, 72%, African Americans, 80% agreeing with that. You know, pretty much everybody, independents, 58% also worried about it. It's only once you get down to, oddly enough, the sort of people who are conducting these attacks, they're not that worried about it. Rural residents is down to 37. Non-college white men, you know what that means, 27%. Republicans, 24%. Now remember, Republicans have done literally nothing for 20 years than be terrified on a daily, minute-by-minute basis about terror attacks. But not this sort of terror attack. As fearful as they are, as ready as they are to be scared of literally everything around them, when it comes to this sort of attack, when you say by a white nationalist, suddenly they're not so scared anymore. Now that could be for a number of different reasons. Maybe they correctly identify that they're not going to be targeted by these sorts of terrorists. Or maybe it's just that It's not really high up on their priorities. They've been taught by media to not worry about it. Anyway, that result, that worries me. Okay, I wish we had more time. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you tomorrow morning with a lot more.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.